A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's the scene. An Israeli water tech startup, let's call them Aquanova, has spent 3 years developing a desalination membrane that cuts energy use by 40%. UNESCO's Intergovernmental Hydrological Program wants to partner with them on a pilot in sub-Saharan Africa. The CEO is sitting in her Tel Aviv office, contract on her desk, and she hesitates. Because she just watched the UN Secretary General call Israel an apartheid state on the evening news. And she's asking herself, am I about to partner with the same organization that just called my country a pariah? So Daniel sent us this one, and it's exactly that tension. The UN is not one thing. Legally, structurally, it's a maze of 30-plus agencies with separate budgets and separate bosses. But it speaks with one voice, and that voice is increasingly hostile to Israel. So the question is, when the Secretary General makes a political statement against Israel, is he speaking for his own office or for the entire UN? And how should Israeli professionals and organizations navigate that ambiguity?
That CEO's dilemma is not unique. It reflects a confusion that runs deep in how we think about the United Nations. A confusion that has real consequences for Israeli professionals and organizations. And the confusion exists because the UN itself has never been especially eager to clarify it.
Because the ambiguity works for them.
Of course it does. If the Secretary General's political statements get attributed to the entire UN system, his words carry vastly more weight. But if a polio vaccination campaign in Gaza succeeds, the World Health Organization gets to claim credit as an independent technical agency. The UN gets to be political when it suits, and apolitical when it suits. That's the asymmetry.
The heads, I win tails. You lose model of international diplomacy.
So let's unpack what the UN actually is, because most people, and I include a lot of journalists in this, talk about it as if it's a single organization with a single leadership hierarchy. It is not. The UN is a system of more than 30 specialized agencies, funds, programs, and affiliated organizations. Each has its own governing council, its own budget contributions, and its own leadership. The Secretary General does not hire the Director General of the World Health Organization. He doesn't set the budget for the International Atomic Energy Agency. He doesn't approve the technical standards issued by the International Civil Aviation Organization.
Yet when he says something about Israel, every headline reads, UN accuses Israel.
That's the attribution problem, and it's not just a media failure, though the media certainly doesn't help. The UN's own branding reinforces this. Every agency uses the same blue logo, the same flag, the same building complex in New York or Geneva. There is no visual or rhetorical distinction between a political statement from the Secretary General's office and a technical report from the World Meteorological Organization. They all carry the UN stamp.
If you're that CEO looking at the UNESCO partnership, the logo on the contract is the same logo you saw behind the Secretary General when he made the statement.
Exactly the same. And that's the trap. Now, to understand why the Secretary General's words carry so much weight, and whether they should, we need to look at the UN's organizational chart, and I promise it's more interesting than it sounds.
Famous last words.
The UN Charter establishes 6 principal organs. The General Assembly, the Security Council, the Economic and Social Council, the Trusteeship Council, which is basically a zombie at this point, the International Court of Justice, and the Secretariat. The Secretariat is the Secretary General's domain. He's the Chief Administrative Officer under Article 97 of the Charter. His staff serve the other organs. They do not serve the specialized agencies.
The Secretariat is essentially the UN civil service.
That's the formal description. But the Secretary General also has a political role under Article 99, which allows him to bring any matter to the Security Council's attention that he believes threatens international peace and security. Antonio Guterres has invoked Article 99 twice, once for Ukraine in 2022, once for Gaza in December 2023. each invocation is a political act, not an administrative one. When Guterres invoked it over Gaza, he described the situation as a, quote, collapse of the humanitarian order, and called for a ceasefire. Israel's ambassador at the time, Gilad Erdan, responded by calling the UN a, quote, terrorist entity.
Which is quite a thing to hear from an ambassador whose country is a UN member state.
And here's where the attribution ambiguity becomes concrete. The same week Erdan made that statement, Israeli water engineers were scheduled to attend the UNDP workshop on desalination in Cyprus. Their visas were delayed, officially for administrative review, but the timing raised eyebrows. Was it causal? Hard to prove. But the perception of contamination was real. The engineers felt they were being penalized for the Secretary General's words.
The political statement from the 38th floor of the Secretariat building in New York had practical consequences for technical cooperation happening thousands of miles away, under a completely different agency.
That's the mechanism, and it works both ways. In March 2025, the UN Human Rights Council published a report accusing Israel of what it called genocidal acts. The report came from the Council, which is an intergovernmental body, not the Secretariat. But every news headline read, UN accuses Israel of genocide. The WHO's polio vaccination campaign in Gaza continued unaffected. The WHO is a specialized agency with its own governance. But Israeli public trust in the WHO dropped 30% in a single month, according to polling data.
30% in a month? That's not a gradual erosion of trust. That's a cliff.
That's the cost of attribution ambiguity. An agency that had nothing to do with the Human Rights Council's report, an agency that was literally vaccinating children, took a reputational hit because the public doesn't distinguish between UN bodies.
Let me ask the legal question directly. When the Secretary General makes a political statement about Israel, is he legally speaking for the World Health Organization?
Legally, he is not. Article 100 of the UN Charter explicitly prohibits the Secretary General and Secretariat staff from seeking or receiving instructions from any government, but it also prohibits member states from trying to influence them. This independence is supposed to protect impartiality. It means the Secretary General answers to no one in the UN system except, in a very loose sense, the General Assembly that appointed him. The specialized agencies have their own directors, general who report to their own governing councils. The WHO Director General reports to the World Health Assembly. The IIEI Director General reports to the IIEI Board of Governors. The Secretary General cannot instruct them.
Legally, the WHO is no more bound by the Secretary General's statements than Canada is bound by a speech from the President of France.
That's the legal reality. But practically, and this is where the whole thing gets sticky, the Secretary General is treated by the media, by publics, and by many governments as the voice of the entire UN system. And the UN's own communication strategy encourages this. When the Secretary General gives a major speech, it's broadcast on UN Web TV, shared across all UN social media accounts, and picked up by every wire service. The specialized agencies don't issue statements saying, by the way, that was just the Secretariat talking, not us.
Of course they don't, because they benefit from the Secretary General's political weight when it aligns with their interests.
And this is where we need to talk about the Israeli perspective specifically. According to a 2024 Israel Democracy Institute poll, 78% of Israeli Jews view the UN unfavorably. That's not a majority, that's a supermajority. And it's driven primarily by two things: the General Assembly's anti-Israel resolution record, over 200 resolutions critical of Israel since 2015, more than against all other countries combined, and the Human Rights Council's Permanent Agenda Item 7, which mandates a standing review of alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territory at every single council session.
Agenda Item 7 is the only country-specific permanent agenda item the Human Rights Council has.
The only one. Every other country-specific human rights situation is addressed under general agenda items. Israel gets its own permanent item. That structural singling out is a major driver of Israeli distrust. And it's not a Secretariat issue. The Human Rights Council is an intergovernmental body whose members are elected by the General Assembly. But again, the public doesn't distinguish. They see the UN singling out Israel, and they conclude the UN is hostile.
We have this structural gap between legal reality and public perception. Now let's look at what that gap means in practice for Israeli scientists, engineers, and diplomats who actually need to work with the UN system.
The practical consequences vary enormously depending on which agency you're dealing with. Let me give you the best case scenario first, the International Atomic Energy Agency. The IIII has a remarkably apolitical track record regarding Israel. Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel in July 2024 and met with Prime Minister Netanyahu without controversy. No Arab state walked out. No emergency session was called.
Because nobody wants to politicize nuclear safety.
But also because of structure. The IIEI's Board of Governors operates by consensus, not majority vote. Its mandate is narrow: nuclear safety, security, and non-proliferation. It doesn't take positions on territorial disputes. Its leadership is careful to stay in its technical lane. Grossi has been explicit about this. The IIII is a technical organization, not a political one. When he speaks about centrifuges and inspection protocols, not about settlements.
The IIII is structurally insulated from General Assembly politics.
And that structural insulation is what makes it safe for Israeli engagement. Now compare that with UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees. UNRWA is structurally embedded in the political conflict. Its mandate is specific to Palestinians. Its funding is voluntary and highly politicized. The United States under the first Trump administration cut all funding, then the Biden administration restored it. Its staff in Gaza have been accused of involvement in the October 7 attacks. The March 2024 Kelowna report, commissioned by the UN itself, found what it called neutrality-related issues, but concluded there was no evidence of mass infiltration by Hamas.
Neutrality-related issues is doing an awful lot of diplomatic work in that sentence.
It's the diplomatic equivalent of saying the patient has health-related issues. But the point is, UNRWA cannot be separated from the conflict because its entire existence is about the conflict. It's the extreme case of political contamination. And that's not a judgment. It's a structural observation. UNRWA was created in 1949 to serve a specific refugee population resulting from a specific war. Its mandate is inherently political.
We've got the I on one end. Structurally apolitical, consensus-driven, narrow mandate, and UNRWA on the other. Structurally political, conflict-embedded, mandate defined by the conflict itself. Most agencies fall somewhere in between.
And that spectrum is what Israeli decision-makers need to understand. Let me give you a case study from the middle of the spectrum, the World Health Organization's Eastern Mediterranean Regional Office, or EMRO. Israel sits in the WHO's Eastern Mediterranean region, which includes 22 countries, most of which do not recognize Israel. In 2024, EMRO's regional director, Dr. Hanan Balki, she's a Saudi national, was criticized by several Arab states for including Israeli health officials in a regional pandemic preparedness exercise. The criticism was public. The pressure was real. The exercise proceeded. Because the WHO's constitution mandates universal membership, you can't exclude a member state from a public health exercise on political grounds without violating the organization's founding document. So the WHO's technical mandate provided partial insulation. But only partial. Balki had to expend political capital to make it happen. The next time, the political cost might be higher.
The insulation isn't automatic. It has to be defended.
And that's exhausting for the people trying to do technical work. Now let me give you a case study from the other end, one that actually works. The International Telecommunication Union. The ITU allocates satellite orbital slots and radio frequencies. This is deeply unsexy work, but it's the backbone of global communications. Israel Spacecom operates the AMIS satellites under ITU coordination. There has never been political interference. The ITU has 193 member states. Its governing structure requires consensus among members. Its technical mandate is so narrow. Radio spectrum allocation, satellite orbit coordination, telecommunication standards, that political disputes rarely enter the room. When a frequency allocation comes up for review, the discussion is about interference patterns and orbital mechanics, not about settlements or borders.
There's something almost beautiful about that. A room full of diplomats from countries that don't recognize each other, arguing about megahertz.
It's the UN at its best, honestly. Technical, cooperative, focused on a shared resource that everyone needs. And here's the key structural feature. The ITU's decisions are made by engineers and technical experts, not by political appointees. The political representatives sign off, but the work is done by people whose professional identity is technical, not diplomatic.
That's the difference between a technical agency and a political body. The people in the room have different incentives.
And that brings us to a framework that Israeli organizations can actually use. When you're considering engagement with a UN agency, ask three questions. First, is the agency's governance based on consensus or majority vote? Consensus-driven bodies like the IEI, and ITU are harder to politicize because any single member can block a political maneuver. Majority vote bodies like the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council are easy to politicize because you just need a voting bloc.
Question one is essentially, can a hostile voting bloc capture this agency?
That's the right way to think about it. Question two, does the agency's mandate require it to take positions on territorial or political disputes? The IIEI's mandate doesn't. UNESCO's mandate, education, science, culture, theoretically doesn't. But in practice, UNESCO has been repeatedly pulled into political disputes about Jerusalem and Palestinian statehood. The mandate may be apolitical on paper, but if it touches territory, culture, or heritage, it becomes political in practice. Has the agency's leadership made political statements about Israel in the past 12 months? This is a leading indicator. If the director general or executive director has felt compelled to comment on Israeli policies, that tells you the agency's political insulation is already compromised. It doesn't mean you can't engage, but it means you need to go in with your eyes open.
Let's score a few agencies. Consensus governance, apolitical mandate, leadership hasn't made political statements about Israel. Score low on all three.
ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, consensus-driven mandate is air safety and navigation standards. Leadership stays in its lane. WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, consensus-driven mandate is patents and copyright, no political statements. ITU, same pattern. The Universal Postal Union, the World Meteorological Organization, these are agencies where Israelis can work without political friction.
On the other end?
The Human Rights Council, majority vote mandate is explicitly political. Agenda Item 7 ensures Israel is criticized at every session, high on all three. UNRWA, governing structure is political. Mandate is conflict embedded. Leadership statements are frequent, high on all three. UNESCO, majority vote in the General Conference, mandate touches cultural heritage in Jerusalem, has been a forum for anti-Israel resolutions. OHCHR, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, part of the Secretariat, so it reports to the Secretary General, mandate is political by definition, leadership has been outspoken on Israel.
The framework gives you a clear answer. If you're that WaterTech CEO, UNESCO scores high on politicization. You should expect political friction. Maybe you still do the partnership, but you go in with political cover, with alternative channels, with a communication strategy that separates the agency from the broader UN brand.
That's the second actionable insight I want to offer. When Israeli professionals engage with a UN agency, they should explicitly separate the agency from the Secretary General's political statements in their own communications. Use language like, "We are engaging with the International Civil Aviation Organization, which operates independently under its own governing council, not with the UN Secretariat." This reframes the relationship. It reduces reputational risk. And it's factually accurate.
It's also a subtle way of educating your own stakeholders. Your board, your investors, your employees. They may share that 78% unfavorable view. If you tell them you're partnering with the UN, they'll wince. If you tell them you're partnering with ICAO, an independent technical agency that happens to use the UN logo, that's a different conversation.
The logo is still there. You can't escape it, but you can contextualize it.
That brings us to the third actionable insight, and this one is a policy ask, not just a communication strategy. Israeli diplomats should push for a formal disclaimer mechanism. When the Secretary General makes a political statement about a member state, the statement should include a disclaimer that it represents the Secretariat only, and does not bind the specialized agencies.
That's not unprecedented. The European Union has a similar mechanism. The EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs makes political statements on behalf of the member states, but those statements are explicitly distinguished from European Commission technical decisions. The Commission's competition rulings, for example, are not attributed to the High Representative. The structural separation is maintained in public communications.
The UN could do the same. It chooses not to.
It chooses not to because the ambiguity amplifies the Secretary General's political power. If every statement had to carry a disclaimer saying, "This is just the Secretariat talking, the WHO and the IIII and ICAO have their own views," the statements would carry less weight. The media would have to qualify their headlines. The public would understand that the UN is not a monolith.
The ambiguity is a feature, not a bug.
For the Secretary General's office, absolutely. For the specialized agencies trying to do technical work in politically sensitive contexts, it's a liability. And for Israeli professionals trying to navigate the system, it's a trap.
Let me push on something. You've laid out the structural argument clearly. The UN is legally heterogeneous. The Secretary General doesn't speak for the specialized agencies. The attribution ambiguity is real and harmful. But here's my question. If the structure is so clear, why does the Israeli public and the Israeli government continue to treat the UN as a monolith?
That's the uncomfortable question.
Because one answer is that the UN benefits from the ambiguity, but another answer is that Israel finds it politically useful to paint the entire organization as hostile.
I think both are true. For the Israeli government, it's politically easier to say the UN is against us than to say the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly majority are against us, but the IIII and the ITU and ITU are perfectly reasonable partners. The first statement mobilizes political support. The second requires nuance, and nuance doesn't win elections.
There's also a historical dimension. The 1975 Zionism is racism. General Assembly resolution, even though it was repealed in 1991, burned itself into Israeli collective memory. That was the General Assembly, not the Secretariat. But it created a template. The UN is the enemy. And once that template is in place, every subsequent hostile act reinforces it, while every instance of technical cooperation gets filtered out.
Confirmation bias at the national level. And the UN's own behavior makes it very easy to confirm. When the General Assembly adopts more resolutions criticizing Israel than all other countries combined, the template holds. When the Human Rights Council maintains a permanent agenda item singling out Israel, the template holds. The fact that these are different bodies with different governance structures doesn't matter to public perception. The logo is the same.
We have a feedback loop. The UN's political bodies are genuinely hostile to Israel. That hostility gets attributed to the entire UN system. Israelis develop a blanket distrust of the UN. The Israeli government finds that distrust politically useful and amplifies it. Israeli professionals who might benefit from engaging with apolitical UN agencies face domestic pushback. The agencies lose Israeli expertise, and the cycle continues.
Breaking that cycle requires something from both sides. From the UN side, structural clarity, the disclaimer mechanism we talked about, or at minimum a recognition that the current ambiguity is damaging technical cooperation. From the Israeli side, strategic discernment, the willingness to distinguish between agencies and engage where engagement is possible.
From the Israeli professional on the ground, the framework we outlined, score the agency. Make a decision based on structure, not on the logo.
Let me add one more dimension to this. As the UN undergoes reform discussions, the Summit of the Future in September 2024 produced a pact for the future that includes vague language about system-wide coherence. The tension between unity and diversity will only grow. System-wide coherence sounds like a good thing. Who's against coherence? But in practice, it could mean further centralization of the UN's communications and political messaging under the Secretary General's office, which would make the attribution problem worse.
The reform that's supposed to make the UN more effective could actually make it harder for countries like Israel to engage with the technical parts of the system.
That's the risk, and it's why Israel has an interest in advocating for structural clarity as part of any reform process. Not the UN is bad, that's not a reform agenda, that's just a complaint. But the UN should make clear which statements represent the Secretariat and which do not bind the specialized agencies. That's a specific, implementable proposal that other member states might actually support.
Because it's not just Israel's problem. Any country that finds itself on the wrong side of the Secretary General's political statements faces the same attribution ambiguity. The difference is that Israel faces it more frequently and more intensely than almost anyone else.
That intensity is measurable. 200-plus General Assembly resolutions since 2015. A permanent Human Rights Council agenda item. 2 Article 99 invocations in 2 years, one of them specifically about Israel and Gaza. This isn't a perception problem. The hostility from the UN's political bodies is real and documented. The question is whether that hostility should prevent Israeli engagement with the parts of the UN that aren't hostile.
Which brings us back to the CEO in her Tel Aviv office. She's got a contract with UNESCO's hydrological program. UNESCO scores high on our politicization framework. But the specific program, water management in sub-Saharan Africa, is technical. It doesn't touch heritage or territory. The people she'd be working with are hydrologists, not diplomats.
What does she do?
She uses the framework. She asks the 3 questions. She recognizes that UNESCO as an institution has been politicized, but this specific program may be insulated enough to be worth the risk. She prepares her communication strategy. We're partnering with UNESCO's Intergovernmental Hydrological Program, a technical body operating under its own scientific mandate. She briefs her board on the distinction, and she goes in with her eyes open.
She accepts that there may be political friction down the line. A UNESCO General Conference resolution on Jerusalem could put her partnership in an awkward position. She needs a contingency plan for that.
That's just good risk management. It's not a reason to walk away from a partnership that could bring desalination technology to communities that desperately need it.
That's the ultimate point. The UN system contains agencies that do important, apolitical work, allocating satellite orbits, coordinating pandemic responses, setting aviation safety standards, managing intellectual property. Walking away from all of them because the General Assembly is hostile would be self-defeating. It would punish Israeli scientists, engineers, and companies while doing nothing to change the political dynamics at the UN.
The alternative is strategic engagement. Know which agencies are safe. Know which ones require political cover. Know which ones are structurally hostile and should be avoided or engaged only through alternative channels. And above all, don't let the blue logo deceive you into thinking you're dealing with a monolith.
One last point on that. The framework we've outlined. Consensus versus majority vote. Mandate politicization. Leadership behavior. It's not just for Israelis. Any country, any organization, any professional who needs to navigate the UN system can use it. The UN's structural heterogeneity is a feature of the system. Understanding it is a prerequisite for engaging with it effectively.
To answer the prompt directly, when the Secretary General makes a political statement against Israel, he is speaking in his capacity as Secretary General of the United Nations Secretariat. He is not legally speaking on behalf of the World Health Organization, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the International Civil Aviation Organization, or any of the other specialized agencies. They are legally independent entities with their own governance and leadership. But practically, the media and the public will attribute his words to the entire UN system. And that attribution has real consequences for Israeli professionals and organizations. The solution is not to treat the UN as a monolith, because it isn't one, but to develop the structural literacy to distinguish between agencies and engage strategically.
That's the episode.
Let's give people the tool. 3 questions for any UN agency you're considering engaging with. 1. Consensus or majority vote. 2. Does the mandate touch political or territorial disputes? 3. Has the leadership made political statements about Israel in the past 12 months? Score low on all 3. IIIII, ICAO, ITU, WIPO, UPU, WMO, and engagement is safe. Score high on RRC, UNRWAY, UNESCO, OHCR, and expect political friction.
If you're an Israeli organization that's been avoiding all UN engagement because of the political hostility, reconsider. You're leaving opportunities on the table. The ITU is not the Human Rights Council. The IIEI is not UNRWA. The logo is the same, but the structure is not.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The scaly foot gastropod, a deep sea snail discovered at hydrothermal vents in the Indian Ocean, is the only animal known to incorporate iron sulfide into its shell and scales, making it literally armored in metal. It was first described in 2001, but its genus name, Chrysomalen, comes from Greek words meaning golden fleece, a reference to the mythical quest, not the metallic armor that actually makes it remarkable.
A snail in chainmail, named after a sheep.
Taxonomy is a strange business.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by the ever-mysterious Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other listeners find the show. We're back next week with a new prompt in a new rabbit hole. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks for listening.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.